Welcome to the Heartbreak Kids Podcast, where we explore what connects us all in our yoga practice and in our lives. This is where I talk to people about their stories, who they are, what they've been through, and where they're going. And in this podcast, that's what we explore. I believe deep down inside, we're all connected, which explains why we bring ourselves to the top of our mat every day. Welcome to the Heartbreak Kids. All right, welcome to the next edition to the Heartbreak Kids. My next guest is David Garee, and he's a certified Ashtanga teacher, and I've been paying attention to this guy for a really long time, and I'm excited to have him on the show. He inspired a lot of my practice in the beginning when I was first getting started with a lot of his Asana Kitchen stuff, and I'm just really excited to kind of hear his take on yoga. So David, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Taylor. I'm excited to that you invited me to do this.
Yeah, so I want to get a little bit of the backstory because I don't know if you share much of, you know, kind of like your past or whatever, but tell us a little bit about where you're from and like kind of where you came from.
Yeah, well, I'm from Seattle. That's where I grew up. And so I'm 57 years old. And so I grew up kind of, was a kid in the 70s and 80s there, and was mostly raised by my mother and have a sister. So my sister, my mom and I, and we moved around a lot in Seattle. And so I went to a lot of different schools and,
Were you good at school?
I was good at school. Yep.
Funny, what was your favorite? What was your favorite subject?
PE.
Same here.
I was good at all the other things too. Funny enough, I was a really serious student. I took my homework seriously, and I did end up going to a small private school for a couple of years in high school.
Okay.
And I liked school, and I liked like studying and tests and stuff, even though I was really rebellious in ways too, and not fitting in. But
yeah. But how did you rebel?
Skateboarding
was definitely rebellious.
Definitely. And especially like in 1976 or whatever in Seattle, like there was not many skateboarders and people were scared of us. And,
sure.
And we would do, renegade skateboarding things like, so rainy in Seattle. Right. Well, and so
right.
there was parking garages with security guards, and we would terrorize those security guards just because we would skate the parking garages. And then we would also, I lived near the University of Washington. That was an amazing campus for skateboarding. And we would go inside the hospital. Like there would be these huge corridors that no one was around, and we would skateboard in the corridors. And I got arrested doing that.
Wow.
Yeah.
Because you were like basically like
trespassing.
Trespassing.
And my mom, she took away my skateboards and locked them in the trunk of her car. But then when she understood, like we had to go to this court and everything, and it was a really stupid scene, and she got mad at him, and so she started defending me and then gave me back my skateboards.
Unlocks the trunk and gives them back to you. She's like, you can do this. That's fine.
Yeah. And I got really into skateboarding. You know, I did it competitively and I rode for a team. And it was something that really anchored me, actually. And
do you still do it today?
I still do it today. I love it. It's a big part of just my worldview is rolling along on the rolling and making like when I don't do it too like in a park or I just ride now and make turns and ride in the streets and sidewalks. And it's just, it's about flow and it's about circles. And it's just so aesthetically pleasing, like better than walking, better than riding a bike. It's just like, that's the way I want to get around or locomote.
Yeah. Or even walk through life.
Yeah.
Or ride through life.
And it definitely, part of my attraction to yoga is connected to skateboarding or like what happens when you skateboard and what happens when you do yoga or when I do. Yeah. And like the yoga's, yeah, it's really interesting. It's so, yeah. It's like a deep version of skateboarding.
Sure. Yeah, of course. And so how did you get into yoga? Like how did that enter the picture for you?
Well, so I lived, I said, but being like, my mom worked a lot. So I was really on my own, especially as like a teenager, even a young teenager. So I started working early. Like I always had paper routes and stuff. And then, so I got a job at a restaurant when I was like 15 or 14 or 15 or 16 or something. And, bussing tables, and there's always an eccentric dishwasher, right?
Every restaurant, yeah.
Yeah. And so I made friends with this dishwasher that was just such a kook. And he was like a real egghead. He ended up owning a bookstore. And so he read a lot of books. He just knew, he had a ton of knowledge about a lot of stuff. And he was really alternative. He was like into anarchy and super outside the norm of things. But he knew about yoga and he introduced me to it. And he taught me the sun salutation outside in a park. And then I just started doing it, but after that, on my own.
And this is just like sun salutation A, and you that first day, like you just continue to do it.
Yeah, like wow. It was the more classic sun salutation. I think there's like 12, but it's like Surya Namaskara A. But yeah, it was so weird, Taylor. Like that, I hooked into this thing, and I didn't really find out more about it either, particularly at that time. Or
I mean, you're only 15 years old though, right? Or 16 years
old. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And but I loved that thing, you know, and I did it outside by myself, and I really took to it.
Did it calm your mind, or what was the appealing about it?
Yeah, well, it calmed my mind, and it just opened my body to, like, felt really good in my body doing it.
Yeah.
Too. Like, and then there's a connection too with the elements. Like, it was different in the skateboarding. Like, just more rooted in one place, more just, more stillness and,
you felt like your attraction was almost immediate though, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's very strange that way. It's like super immediate and then lasting. Because like I did it because then I got into punk rock as I was in my last year of high school. Like I really got into it big time.
And, you had a mohawk?
I wasn't into the mohawk.
Okay.
But
all right.
I was totally into the Seattle underground punk scene. It was lucky it was the last year of high school, because after that I dropped out of everything. I did graduate from high school, but I ended up just living on the street and like totally getting into the music scene and the crowd.
Yeah.
And I still did sun salutations.
Wow.
Even then.
I mean, did all the punk rockers think that you were crazy?
I don't remember them actually ever. I didn't publicize it, or I didn't really do it in front of other people.
Yeah.
And I must have not done it all the time. Like, you know, I can't say that I kept with, there's probably times when I didn't do it, but it was definitely something that stayed with me through the years. And because I didn't get to a yoga class until I was at least 27 or like more than 10 years later.
Wow. And was your first yoga class like an Ashtanga class, or was it a Iyengar class, or like just a vinyasa?
So my first yoga class, you're not going to believe this. So all I remember about it is that we were in child's pose, and the woman came and pushed down on my back a little bit, and I hated that, and I didn't ever, that was it. I was done with yoga classes.
Because of the adjustment?
Yeah. And then, but then I did. So the reason that I went to a yoga class is because, I ended up going to college. I did get back to college, and I went to Evergreen State College, and I did a whole alternative thing there. It was a amazing school, actually. And from the past, it kind of became more and more normalized, but it still was pretty radical in some ways when I went there. And one of the things you could do is if you could get a teacher to sponsor what you wanted to do, you could do anything. You could write your program and get credit.
Wow. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And so you did yoga.
I did meditation, macrobiotic cooking and yoga. But I was also like very lost.
How so? What do you mean?
Because I was trying to figure out what I was going to do, you know, like, and I didn't really know it at the time, like how important work is or was going to be to me, like that I wanted to do something important to me, like that I feel like I'm making a difference. And I was a unusual person, so no kind of conventional channel was working for me. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up like really floundering for, yeah, like a long time, more than 10 years, like as a punk, and then at college. And I was like, I found Outward Bound.
What's that?
Wilderness kind of, you go out in the wilderness, but it has a more of a kind of, it's called soft skills. It's not like technical climbing as much as it is like kind of group interactions and psychology and stuff. And so I went on a course in Maine, far away from Washington as I could get. And I loved it. And so I started working there. They invited me back to be a guide. And so I started doing that in the summers. And I was considering making that my career. But I couldn't commit on anything.
Well, you struggled with commitment, or it just didn't feel like it was
commitment
supposed to.
And like certainty about like direction. And confidence. Okay. Like I think like me, like I partly went to Evergreen because I didn't think I was good enough to go to the University of Washington. You know, like I had a really was challenged with confidence and direction. And so part of this was that I started running. I started running distance running,
like marathon.
And I'd always been kind of into that. Like I did track when I was younger.
Yeah.
And so I kind of had a natural affinity for that. And I graduated from college, and then I didn't continue with Outward Bound. And then I was really lost because I had nothing. And so I started running like really seriously, and I decided I was going to do the Seattle Marathon.
Oh,
it was in 1990, 2001, I think. And I was so serious about it, I hired a coach. And like the first day I met that coach, he met me at the track and he wanted to like get a feeling for like what I was up to. And so he did put me through some drills and he goes, "So what do you want? What's your goal for this?" And I said, "Well, I want to do that Seattle Marathon in under 3 hours." And he goes, "Well, I'll train you to win it."
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a bold statement.
Yeah. And so, so I did end up getting, third or fourth place.
Wow. That's crazy.
I only started training in the summer and I did it in November. And
holy crap. So you were a good runner.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, but I got super tight. I was running like more than 70 miles a week. And I was trying to keep, I was definitely doing my sun salutations. And by that time I had added yoga, like I had gotten a copy of Light on Yoga. And I looked at the pictures and pretty much just did a pick and choose. It was like, yeah, I like that one. So I had a little routine that I would do. And I had still never had any instruction. But I got so tight from the running that I actually went to a yoga class.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to do long distance running like that, I mean, man, it just destroys your body. Jeez, it's hard on it. Yoga is like the best solution for that.
Yeah. And so I ran to yoga to and from. but then I fell in love with yoga.
Why?
I don't know. I was just.
Was it the teacher? Totally, was it the class? Like,
it was definitely not the teacher because okay. I ended up, I'm not going to say who it is, but I ended up not. I mean, he actually taught me some good things, but I ended up not thinking that it wasn't for me anyway. Yeah. But he was very serious and I started taking it seriously and then I did find a teacher in Seattle that really did it for me. This old woman she was a Czech woman, like it's Eastern European. Gotcha. They called her the Iron Maiden of yoga.
Oh my God. Like,
yeah. She was radical, but so, in a good way, like the, you know, yoga is like the razor's edge, right? It's a sword. It's like strong, and it's strong medicine to address real suffering, you know, like it can cut through. And this woman helped me to like figure out, help slowly sort through all my confusion and pain and like get me on a track that I'm still on.
Yeah. What was the confusion about? Just like where your life was supposed to go?
Yeah. Yeah. Just like where to put my energy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where do I belong in this world? And
that's awesome. So, and so the Iron Maiden was the person who initiated your path.
Definitely.
What kind of yoga was it?
It was her own. She didn't, it was not a style that she wasn't like Iyengar or anything. It was her own. That's part of why I loved it. So I still love it. Like what she did. One of the things is she was a creative vinyasa teacher in a way because to her the way that you got into the posture or the way you worked when you were in the posture was everything. The moment the process stopped and like you stopped working or trying to like kind of seek some expression to extract something from your pose or she lost interest. And so she was all about how you do it, the means that gets you to think. So she taught, and so I took that like this real dynamism and just the means more important than the end.
Wow. Sounds like she made a pretty big impact on you.
Yeah.
So how long did you take her classes for?
Well, I can be intense, you know, and so I moved into this weird shack, like in Seattle, right? It's the big city, but I lived in a one room shack. It was like, could have been in shanty town. I could walk to her studio, and I went to every class. So she taught two times a day, not every day, but like three or four times a week. And I went to her both the morning and the evening. And she had two classes in the morning and two in the afternoon. And one was the exact same beginner class that she had taught for like the whole time, 40 years. Wow. So it was always the same. And I still went to it, both of them, every day. And I did it for about at least 2 years. And that's where I saw a tape of Pattabhi Joyce teaching. It's from her studio.
Wow.
And then I also saw that he was coming to Yoga Works in California for 1 month. And I decided I was going to go there. I'd never done Ashtanga or anything. And so
you packed up your stuff and headed out to California?
Yep.
Wow.
I camped in Topanga Canyon and took classes every morning. It was about 30 people.
Was it Mysore style or was it
lead classes? It was lead primary.
Wow, for a month.
Every day. Yep.
And what was your first what was your first experience of Pattabhi Joyce?
Well, for one, I was completely terrified of the whole thing.
It looked hard, or for what reason were you terrified?
So when you asked me the confusion, like where, what it was, a lot of it was fear, Taylor. I had so much fear, like insane amount of fear about just almost everything. Like just the most basic stuff. I'd be terrified of, like, I was a waiter. I worked in restaurants a lot, when I was trying to, you know, sort out what I was doing. It ended up being for a long time. And I was always like a cook or a prep person or something. And so I purposely decided I'm going to go be a waiter so I can have to talk to people. It terrified the shit out of me. Like me, every time I'd have to tell someone the special, I would get literally nervous, like shaking. And that's how scared I was.
Wow.
And so for me to go to Pattabhi Joyce, like it was this big thing. Like I was so scared. I can't even tell you. Like, and for some reason I decided that food was bad. So I ended up eating fruit for the whole month.
Oh my God.
Because I was so scared.
Were you skin and bone by the time you got?
I was skin and bones. Yes. And I was also very stiff. And so when I stayed away from Pattabhi Joyce because I was so, it was just enough to be in the room with it.
Sure.
But he did a couple of things he did. One thing he did in that month was, I saw him adjusting people in the videos. I wanted to do, like, I just had such a idealistic bent in every way, you know, like I just wanted to do the deepest yoga. And like when I saw him adjusting people, I was scared of it, but I also wanted to go deep into yoga, you know?
Sure.
And and then in the class, he would adjust people, but he didn't really adjust me much, but he did a couple of things. One is funny. So Brian, I'll say his name. I don't know. You can bleep it out if you want. But Brian Kest, you know, the power yoga guy.
Sure, of course.
So he was in the class. And of course he was like, the thing happened at Yoga Works. And so he was a kind of yoga star there. And I knew nothing. I was just new to it all, you know. And so I was in awe of him, even though I didn't even know who he was. And he was doing handstands at, just like in, from every jump back. So he would go, you know, he'd go to jump back and he'd go up into a handstand. And I was like, and I was a skateboarder, you know, that wasn't that big a deal to me, actually. And so I started doing it, you know, and I was thinking, man, this is amazing, right? And so Patavi Joyce, he would shake his head at Brian, but me, he's like, I'm not letting this guy do that. And so he came up right. I was just doing it. I was going up into a handstand and he hit my legs down.
And knocked you down with like chaturanga or something?
Yeah. Yeah. And I was like, okay, I get the message. No, don't get carried away on the handstands. So he did that. And then he also adjusted this guy, this one guy that was super stiff in Buddha Konasana every day. It was the dramatic moment of the day. Because this guy would turn purple and like it was a whole thing.
And you were sitting there watching it already terrified.
I'm sitting there watching the thing happen, right? And so, and I was stiff in Buddha Konasana too. So, so he comes over to me finally one day. And so I'm sitting there just terrified, right? And he puts one foot on one knee and one hand on the other. And he like kind of somehow shoved my head forward, like, and showed me the ground down there. Like I was way up, way, yeah, right. You know, it was, and I thought, oh, here it is. You know, I'm going down. And I was just totally terrified. And it was actually a really mystical moment because it kind of time stopped for a second. It was a really strange thing because he showed me this thing. He showed me something like this possibility. And then he pulled me back up and he said, no fearing you go. Oh, fuck, no fearing. Like fear was this kind of thing that was so big for me, and that's what he said. It was big.
Sounds like it was huge.
And then Chuck Miller was he owned Yoga Works at that time, and he took me under his wing a bit, and he like was, you have to go to Mysore, and I was not, I had no plan to go to India or anything like that. That was a total shocker to me. But I went.
When did you go?
Like the very next, it was in 93 that I went to LA, and I went to India in 94. Wow. And
then you were there practicing Mysore style in the old Chala?
In the old Chala, yep.
And how long did you, yep. How long did and you I, stay?
I stayed for 4 months the first time, but then I really went for it. I just worked enough to make money and went back. And so I went for something like 8 months the next time. And then I did the same thing again. I went for a 1 year.
Wow. That had to be hugely transformational that whole year there.
Totally.
What year was that?
It was 96. Wow. I got 95 and 96.
How many times have you been to Mysore?
I've lost count, but more than 10.
Wow, yeah. That's crazy. And so tell me what your experience was with, you know, Patavi Joyce in Mysore.
It was always, the thing was, is I was, so I was fearful and like non-committal. It was really kind of dodgy. And so he just left me alone. basically. He did not.
For months?
He did not teach me much. And it was a weird thing because like I needed that, but eventually I got totally frustrated with that. I started judging. I started getting really bummed. It's like, I got my partner at that time. She became my wife. She was like one of his favorite students. So she got adjusted all the time. We worked with, and I never did. And so I started like obsessing about it, like just wondering what I was doing there. And
because you felt like you weren't getting what you needed,
I wasn't getting what I needed. It was just this game. And it's a little bit hard to talk about this now with the whole atmosphere around his sexual abuse allegations, you know, because
of course.
But for me, like, yeah, I don't know. At that time, I don't know. Everybody was in awe of him and like really just wanting to learn, you know? And I wanted to learn. And part of it was about, it's weird. It's hard to talk.
Did you feel like you were, did you feel like you were like being taught a lesson or something?
Yeah,
or?
That's the thing that I felt like is that he wasn't ignoring me. He was deliberately messing with my head and like giving me medicine, you know, like because he would give me these little flashes of things and that would indicate that it was like, we're playing chess here, you know, and right. this is his move now. And then he's looking for my next move. And so I feel like I had to go through this thing where I wanted his attention, and it was a father thing, no question, you know, like, cause I grew up not with my father and I felt abandoned by my father. And I think part of my fear was just challenges with, being a man and not even having a father figure growing up and, you know, things like that. And also I think I had a lot of trouble with a male authority. That's what was part of the punk thing and part of the not wanting to be part of the world in a conventional way. Like, you know, and so this was it for me. It was like a moment of like, so are you going to have a relationship with a, you know, an older man, a father figure? Is this going to happen? And it was challenging because he wasn't giving me any attention, just like my father. Right. And so I started, I just was obsessed about it. I compared him adjusting all, because there was a small group of us. There's only like 25 people or something, right?
And there was a small group. Jeez.
Yeah. And everyone, you know, lived together and ate together. And, ate, you know, it was just a very close-knit group. And it was all mostly teachers now, right? It's like a who's who list of practitioners to a certain degree. And so I almost quit, you know, and then I also, there was the inappropriate touching that I saw, because I also, one of the things that I had always done was like, I watched the woman, Marie, the older woman that I learned from back in Seattle, is like, I was so into how she taught people. Even though I had no plan to teach or anything, I would follow her around. Everywhere she went, I would go and watch how she worked with people. And when Guruji would, after I finished practicing, because I would practice it early, I would sit on the stairs and watch the whole thing because I wanted to see how his adjustments and like how he interacted with people. It was really interesting to me. And for the most part, I did not see harmful adjustments or even questionable things. I saw like amazing interactions and like transformation happening and, you know, like really powerful teaching and somebody passionate. And I did see like ones where it's like, wow, you know, that
across the line or something.
Across the line, right. That's weird. Like, I don't know. But nobody was saying anything. And I just sort of, but it was a question in my mind that was part of the whole equation of doubt of like, what am I doing here? Is this like really healing and growth and like amazing learning going on? Or is this weird and wrong? And, one thing I did do, which is I finally resolved it by deciding to practice. And I stopped looking around when I was practicing. I stopped caring. I stopped comparing. I stopped giving a shit at all who got what adjustment and what that. I just went into my own body, in my own practice. And literally that shift then – he started working with me differently. Wow. As soon as I made that shift.
You made that conscious shift, like, and I mean, that was like a thought process that you had in your head and you changed it. And then all of a sudden he started working with you different.
Exactly. Like, wow. Like it was like the chess. Okay. He goes, okay, there, I was waiting for your move. But it wasn't like chess in the sense that we're working together. He's like, there, now you've got some independence and now we can work, you know, and it's something that never left me, Taylor, that independence, like that fear and all this, it lessened from then.
Wow.
And it's happened, you know, way more through the years, but it was a total psychological shift. Like amazing.
Wow. Yeah. So I'm wondering, and I mean, just to shift gears a little bit, you know, because obviously, you know, Patabi Choice played a huge impact on your life and, you know, gave you, you know, a different outcome, different perspective on yourself. But like now in the current situations that are being presented to us, like how do you reconcile that in your head?
Yeah. Well, I do.
I
have a podcast about it so that people can listen to that if they want to. I feel like it addresses it pretty well. But for me, it's nearly impossible to reconcile because there's so much contradiction in it and because there's a whole collective kind of atmosphere or truth or perspective or, you know, and then and it is one of the ways that I do deal with it, actually, is that I divide it. I have within myself, I allow myself to have all of my own feelings and truth about it. And then even if nobody out there agrees with me or, you know, or dislikes me for how I feel or whatever, I still allow myself to have my own private processing of it all. And that's helpful to me because I can trust myself and so I sort through it and and it's an ongoing thing and it can't really leave me because it's big. And I'm appreciate like, and it's interesting because I had that question all way back and sure. And to a certain degree I had dropped it, you know, and not really and let it go and gone for the really positive take on Patavi Joyce. But with what's come out, you know, recently, it's forced me to reopen it all. And that's challenging, but I'm also thankful for that. So I do, I process it in myself. And partly why I feel like I need that private time or the private space to deal with it is because of the contradiction and that
it's definitely a hard situation.
He helped me.
Yeah.
An incredible amount. And I know he helped others.
That's the big controversy or that's the big contradiction is that, you know, he helped people, but you know, obviously there's people that he harmed.
Yeah. And he harmed me part of it is, this anger towards him, that's part of what I process. It's this just anger of because we're teachers, right? And we're stewards of yoga. And so that when we fall and when we fall hard and big and we, you know, that's a blow to yoga. That's like,
sure.
That's hard.
Big blow. You know? Yeah. It's super hard.
And yoga has the potential to be a integral part of the human health. It's just so, so sad and challenging when my own important mentor let us down in that and just the harm that he caused to people.
I can tell obviously how much the yoga means to you. I mean, just how you speak about it, all that stuff. I mean, what is yoga to you today? You know, as you process all of this, these things that are going on and you move forward with your teaching and your practice, what does it even mean to you today?
Well, it's just it's this integral part of well-being. And it's more than well-being too, because it's like how to be truly alive and to lessen your own suffering and the suffering of the world. So yoga is a centerpiece of that. You know,
is that why you do it?
That's why I do it. It's like the center, it's the rock, it's the foundation of my day. So it's just where all the things, where I set everything kind of straight for the day. Set everything, I build the foundation for my day. And I draw power for that day. I draw power to make good choices and put my energy where I think there's value and meaning. And so, and it's a personal thing. Like it's amazing to me, like how much has grown the importance of my personal practice to me. And it has nothing to do with like series or advanced asanas or something like that.
Mm-hmm. What does that have to deal with?
It has to deal with just with knowing myself and honoring myself and just spending time. Like this is a big thing. Like feel like like I said, a centerpiece of the human life.
Do you feel like you still have as much fear as what you did, like as you were describing earlier?
No.
Or has that lessened dramatically?
Radically.
Because I look at you and, you know, obviously I know you teach workshops. I know that you have a great following, all of that stuff. It's like, well, how does someone with that much fear, you know, sit in front of 20, 40, 50 people and like give a discourse on or give a workshop on yoga?
No, I know. Well, I've gone through. I'll just tell you. I used to get afraid to the shaking point every time I would say samastitihi for the invocation. Yeah.
Yeah. I get nervous for that too. Actually. Yeah. Like, especially with new groups. I'm like, oh, my voice starts getting a little shaky, you know?
And so giving talks, and I'm still afraid, but I've walked through it now, you know, thousands of times, but I have literally forced myself.
Yeah.
But it's one of the things though that yoga has, that's why I love it so much. It's because and I'm talking about hatha yoga, like triangle pose and sarvangasana and pranayama, like those things, they take fear. They take it away. They give you courage, you know, like literally, and they give you, it's a technology that helps you, and it's designed to help you, and so that's why I keep using it, because I can fall into fear easily again, and although it'd be different fears, but it'd be fear all the same. Yeah. And of course, look at the world, look at the predicament. The different, you know, problems are abound. And so it's very easy to fall into despair, into fear, and to inertia and abuse and all kinds of things. And so I need that technology. And then, but I do take it to, for me, I feel fortunate or blessed that I can, that I also take it to the next step, which is sharing it with people. And then, so I'm passionate about that, about giving it to you and to people so that they can also empower themselves and do what they want to do and envision themselves doing.
Do you feel like, you know, because earlier, you know, you said you had a bunch of confusion and you wanted to do something important with your life. Do you feel like you found that with yoga?
I do. Yeah. That's what's amazing to me about it. Like,
and how does that interact with the students that are, you know, around you from time to time? Like, how does that like infuse your teaching?
Well, I feel like, well, for one, see, like, to me, because I've always been a very athletic person, like it's like with the running And I even got invited to Outward Bound to work there because of my athleticism. It wasn't because I'd never camped. I was a mama's boy, right? I didn't know anything about the outdoors, but I could scramble up a rock, you know. And so, I don't know, I could have been an athlete or could have been a skateboarder, right? But it wasn't, it's not enough. Like yoga, it has everything. Like, and in school, I studied, among other things, I studied psychology. And that was like really where I was headed. If I would have gone a more conventional route, I would have been a psychologist, you know, for sure. But then that somehow would not have encompassed it. And then I could be a priest or a monk because I have this interest in spirituality. And here, yoga, it encompasses all of those in one thing. It's just an incredibly complete thing for me, right? And I feel like that's what I infuse into the student, is that I bring all of those dimensions, right? And I encourage the person not to just be physical in the yoga.
Yeah.
And to go to the psychological places with yoga and to bring psychology into yoga. And then also to bring the spirituality that the whole thing that yoga is founded upon. And so
it's a beautiful practice, isn't it? I mean, it just encompasses all of those aspects that you're talking about. And it's just, I mean, psychological and spiritual and physical and like all of those things. I mean, so much can get worked out on your yoga mat. It's really unbelievable. Like how, you know, a lot of times people say, oh, yoga's changed my life or all of that stuff. And it's like, it has that for me. You know, it's not like a cliche. It's like,
yeah,
it's crazy how I think, why I act the way that I act, why, you know, like how, you know, I teach and like what, how I'm trying to give back and just everything, how I feel deeply inside and how I feel connected to other people. It's just, it's actually magnificent. I don't even know if that word describes it, but maybe it's as close as I could get to it.
No, you're saying it. It's so true. And, yeah. And it's so practical. It's like, it's like a practice that you do every day to win those things, to win your health, physical, psychological, and spiritual. And I mean, and of course, we're not saying that it's, you just need yoga. Like not,
there's more than that.
The Trini Foundation and, you know, it's not saying that there's not a place for therapy and different things like that. I just want to be clear that, but it's just amazing what that one thing, that one discipline, how much it can encompass and how much it can help, even if there's other parts of the recipe to, you know, physical, psychological and spiritual health. And my teaching has changed because I've also, it's weird, but one of the outcomes of Patabi Joyce is transgressions is it's been this crazy freeing thing for me, Taylor. And it's not just Patabi Joyce, because it doesn't matter where you look. There's so much. There's like what you see is the people from the past, even the wise ones, had a major flaws and shortcomings. And what it leaves me with is that nobody knows how to be happy and how to know. So there, And so, and that could be like very depressing or, you know, overwhelming, but to me, it's very empowering. What it means is that I've got to find it. Like, there's all that yoga technology, but I have to apply it. And I really have to trust myself. And I have to allow myself the freedom to explore those things for myself. And because the person from the past, they might have discovered some amazing things, but not amazing enough that I should follow that blindly. And I don't even think it's supposed to work that way. I think that what's supposed to happen is you're supposed to learn to think for yourself, and you're supposed to figure out what Uddiyana Bandha means to you, what those postures are, what the breathing is, and how those fit into your life, and what kind of life you make for yourself. And that includes like living the yamas and niyamas and the very deep aspects of yoga. And so the prescriptions from the past they're rough guidelines, not precise guidelines that have to be rigidly followed in a certain way because a certain person said it was that way.
Yeah.
And so
that's a great thought.
That's what I try to teach is that it's frowned upon the degree to which each person actually needs to come up with their independent view of their own life and the world.
Yeah. Or even how they transmit Ashtanga yoga too.
Yeah.
I mean, they're, you know, like, you know, the fundamentalist of Ashtanga yoga, like they don't like the variance between all of these, you know, I was taught this way. It's supposed to be this way. You're supposed to do it that way. And that's what leads us to, you know, this higher truth or, you know,
exactly,
more knowledge in the
too.
Body. And I've had a lot of a freeing experience too. I never practiced with Patabi Joyce, never interacted with him. Sharat's been my teacher the entire time. And, you know, and there's definitely this thinking that everything is supposed to be the same for everyone. And there couldn't be, you know, anything further from the truth. It's just, it's actually bullshit in my opinion.
Yeah. You know? Detrimental.
Yeah, true.
And so it's nice to feel free of that. I used to be way more scared and concerned with, you know, what people would think or being wrong too. You know, you don't want to be wrong, but
I hear that. And also like, I feel like, you know, with your teaching, you know, because I think that, you know, it is a more progressive approach to Ashtanga yoga. I mean, you use blocks and straps and all that stuff. And a lot of times I felt like, you know, from an outsider that it put you on the outside of like this tradition thing that we talked about all the time. Did you feel that too?
I totally feel that. And
why do you teach with blocks? Like, why, like, you know, if you're talking to the fundamentalists, like why is that? Is it because, is there a reason behind it?
There's a deep reasoning behind it. But I don't think I can explain it to you in the scope of this podcast. So for one though, I'll try to keep it short, but really, I don't know. There's a bunch of reasons, Taylor, but one is that I honestly, it doesn't, for me, my own psyche, my own sense of like what makes up a lineage, the fact of using blocks or not does not disturb that at all. Like, it's not an interesting even line of reasoning to me. Like that, I don't find it outside the tradition already. I just don't. It's like, whatever. I mean, it's just like using a mat or something. Using a block is, it just gives you an advantage. Like
right.
it helps to show you something about the posture that's useful and that you can benefit from. Yeah. It's a very logical, very logical way to practice.
I from the very get-go, I use blocks and straps. I had never been taught that way, but like there is benefit to it, you know. But you know, for someone like yourself, and this was always interesting, and because obviously you're not the only one, but you know, for someone like yourself to, you know, to be outside of like this mainstream of what Ashtanga typically teaches, and for someone to make such a big impact as what you have, it's interesting because, you know, most of the time, like you see in like these kind of settings that everyone kind of falls in line.
And yes.
You didn't, you know, yeah. And I applaud you for that, for like having some sort of freedom and independence and having like creative thought behind it. All of that stuff. But it also, I mean, for some extent, it sort of puts a target on your back.
No, you know? Taylor, I know. Well, this is part of the fear thing, right? Yeah. Like, and I've been, I've walked through so much fear to do these things, you know? And, but it makes sense to me. And so that's truth to me. And, yeah. And that's
all that matters, actually.
That's what matters. Like, And also, I use those things, you know, like, and also there's a protection element that's super important to me. And that also goes with the, because to me, the Ashtanga, it's the sexual abuse is only part of the picture. Right, a bigger part is the harmful adjustments and the not regarding skeletal alignment principles that is pretty much epidemic in Ashtanga.
Yeah,
and blocks and straps and props and thinking in props and thinking in steps, those are things that address and that ensure the safety and that make Ashtanga a sustainable practice. Okay, so like to me, doing shoulder stand without the support under your shoulders is dangerous, and it gives people an aversion to the pose, which there's plenty of evidence for, because people that do Ashtanga, they actually save themselves from harm because they only stay in shoulder stand for about 25 seconds or less. Yeah. And then they're done with it. But they miss that this is an amazing pose. But you got to put height under your shoulders so that you protect your neck. And I'm sorry that for whatever reason, 99% of the people, if they don't use that height, they're going to end up with the reverse curve of the cervical spine if they really do shoulder stand. Like, you know, the physical therapists, they don't like shoulder stand and headstand, and they have some basis for it. But you've got to use those props to make them safe, because then when they become safe, they go from detrimental to life-giving, like, they're some of the best medicine on the planet for a healthy body. You see, so that's why I will use a prop. It's like you have to. Yeah.
Well, I mean, with that philosophy, I mean, you've helped me understand it better, and I've never given you a hard time for it or any of that stuff. But it's interesting because, you know, you're outside of what I would call like the mainstream of what Ashtanga yoga teacher teaches. And so it's interesting to hear the perspective, because I mean, I don't know if anyone's ever asked you that. And so I'm sitting here like, you know, I got him on here, and I have the friends who are Ashtanga fundamentalists, and they're not so fun, you know, like,
it's
like, I don't have them on the podcast, if you know what I mean. But
yeah.
So, but
like Taylor and Dropbacks is a perfect example that most people aren't ready to drop back to the ground. And that's why I use the wall and our pads, because it's the safety and the alignment that dictates what you do.
Yeah.
And not the end goal. And see, that's what I was telling you about that teacher Marie, how she instilled that in me, that the means are much more important than the end. And that the end, if you achieve it with shoddy means, you've got trouble coming. And see, in Ashtanga, it doesn't have to be focused on the end, but the way the whole way the discipline is set up, you can fall into that, right? Like, sure, you won't do second series till you can drop back. So, well, you better drop back any way that you possibly can, you know, or you better bind your Marichyasana or get your leg behind your head. And these kinds of ideas are, they're wonderful if they just playfully motivate you. They're terrible if they become these fast rules that, you know, determine whether you're ever going to do a new pose or not.
Yeah. Yeah. I hear you loud and clear. Well, I really appreciate you being on the show today and sharing your story and sharing, you know, obviously about, you know, Patabi Joyce and your thoughts with that and really just sharing your, you know, your teaching philosophy. You got a beautiful mind, man. And I appreciate all the support that you've given me and the Trini Foundation. It means a lot to me and a lot to the people that, you know, get scholarships from us and stuff like that. It means a lot. And, you know, I hope our paths cross soon. And I hope that, you know, one day I can, you know, obviously do some learning with you.
Yeah. And Taylor, I really thank you for inviting me and including me in your world and your podcast. Like, cause then I feel like not like an outsider, and I really appreciate it. And,
Well, you're not an outsider in my book, so I appreciate all of the time, and I'd love to have you on again, and maybe we could talk about, you know, a little bit more in depth yoga, and you know, we could talk about sutras and Gita.
That'd
and
be
all
excellent.
That stuff.
I would love that.
I could hear like, you know, when you were talking philosophy, like you were like you got passionate about it. So I'm sure there's a lot there that we could talk about as well.
Yeah, I'd love to.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, right, David. And yeah. I appreciate all of your time and thanks for being on the show.
Hey guys, thanks for tuning in. If you want more information about Ashtanga Yoga, visit ashtangayogacolumbus.com. You can also check out my website, which is taylorhuntyoga.com. See you guys next time.